Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News everywhere this week, from the world of pop to Capitol Hill to the world abroad. President Obama took a tougher tone and came down hard on Iran's leaders.
The United States and the international community have been appalled and outraged by the threats, the beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days.
And South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford tearfully confessed to an affair in a press conference for the history books.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with what started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your view on events in Iran? What about the South Carolina governor's tearful confession? How do you see the health care fight shaping up? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Of course, the story of the moment, topping all others right now, Michael Jackson, musical legend, died in Los Angeles yesterday at the age of 50. Let's listen to just a bit of his 1988 number one hit, Man in the Mirror. I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. And no message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a change. We'll talk more about Michael Jackson later this hour, but joining me now from London is Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. She's just back from Iran. Rula Khalaf, welcome.
Hi, Jack.
And joining me from Providence, Rhode Island, is Froma Harrop, nationally syndicated columnist and editorial board member at the Providence Journal. She also blogs at realclearpolitics.com. Froma, glad to have you with us.
Hello, Jackie.
And also from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, here each week. Hi there, Jack.
Hello, Jackie, Rula, and Froma.
Well, we are glad to have all of you. And let's do something just a little bit different this week. Rula, my understanding is that you just got back from some time in Tehran only last evening.
Yes, indeed. Yesterday afternoon.
Well, we are very glad for your close physical proximity to events, as great a risk as I'm sure that that was. First of all, would you just give us your last impressions as you were leaving the country? And then I want to come to some news that coming out of Friday prayers today.
I'd say two things. One is that it was still tense. And I think particularly for people like us, because this week the whole crisis sort of turned to trying to find a scapegoat. And that scapegoat is Britain, the U.S., you know, the outside world.
And the media.
Indeed, and the media, and particularly actually the British media. At the same time, I think what's changed this week is that the crackdown on the protests has made them much smaller and in some cases a bit more violent, because as soon as they start, as soon as people try to assemble, they immediately move against them. So it's been much, much tougher this week for the opposition to try to stage protests, and they seem to be scrambling for new ways of expressing their grievances. At the same time, I think the regime has moved very clearly to what we will see in a few days, and that is a sort of final declaration that the results of the elections will not be altered.
Mm-hmm. Today, at Friday prayers, which occur each week, well, throughout the country, of course, but also at Tehran University, an Ayatollah, Ahmed Hatemi, not to be confused with the previous president of the country, said that the government should punish the leaders of the protests, quote, strongly and with cruelty. And he also alleged that a woman who's become iconic, Neda Aga Sultan, who was killed last week in that sad video shown around the world on YouTube of her death, that he alleged that she had been killed by protesters as opposed to these besiegees or anyone else other than protesters. First of all, let's go to this call for strong, cruel public punishment of protest leaders. What does that mean to you?
I think it means that they're threatening the death penalty, probably. And I think it's part of a pattern that we've seen over the past week in order to intimidate and essentially dissuade people from taking to the streets. They have done, you know, all sorts of things, including claiming that the rioters are killing people rather than the Basijis or the security forces, and arresting a lot more people and threatening to put people on trial, charge them with all sorts of crimes. And I think this latest falls into that pattern. Every single day there are two or three statements, either from the Revolutionary Guard or from the Intelligence Ministry or the Interior Ministry, all threatening punishment and making it a lot more threatening for people to come out.
You know, could maybe you give us an understanding, Rula, of how quickly I think we can call it the Khomeini Ahmadinejad regime almost at this point, even though they've tried to not publicly be together too much. Neil McFarquhar had a piece in the New York Times the other day talking about Ahmadinejad's expanding about 10,000 people who had Revolutionary Guard or Iran-Iraq war backgrounds into various segments of the government so that they can act very quickly, go house to house, round up hundreds of people in a single day. Can you comment on that?
What I see is an attempt to use what people in Iran call the plainclothes, essentially, not the regular police or the regular military forces, but rather the ones that answer, that are more ideologically driven and that answer to the supreme leader more directly in a way, and use them in order to suppress the protests. And I think that is because it is much more difficult for the police, who have, you know, relatives who are probably Mousavi supporters. I mean, they are probably, some of them are Mousavi supporters. So I think in order not to create any cracks in the police and in the regular military forces, they've used these plain clothes in order to suppress the opposition.
Can we come back to all the comments that have been made this week? You used the word Kafkaesque about the British government being behind this. Now, historically, of course, British had been in Iran and extracted oil. But it is a throwback to almost colonial times to denounce the British government in these terms.
But, you know, in Iran, anything that goes wrong is almost immediately blamed on Britain. It's like a national joke. But I think that the reason that they sort of went for the for Britain this time has a lot to do with the BBC Persian service. They've been very upset about the BBC Persian service, the television, the new television station, and they've been trying to do something about it. And I think they took this crisis as an opportunity, given that there was very, very little information that was being distributed within Iran, because there were restrictions on, you know, absolutely everything. More people were obviously listening to the BBC, to the Persian service, and to VOA. And so a lot of people knew about protests through these satellite stations. And so when you're trying to come up with a narrative that wants to blame what's happening on outsiders, this was a sort of obvious immediate target.
And can we just talk about those Iranian and dual citizen journalists who have been detained? Some of our colleagues, we don't know the names of all the people from the Reformist newspaper who were taken into custody, but others were. There was a Greek citizen from the Washington Times, Mazyar Bahari of Newsweek. What is your thought about what is happening to Reporters Without Borders? Says several dozen people. We don't know the exact number, but certainly at least a couple dozen.
Yes, I think that there are dozens of reporters from Reformist newspapers, and as you say, we don't know exactly who they are. But I think there are two categories of people that are being targeted. One is the Reformist press. They're trying to put as much pressure as possible on the Reformist press. The others are people that they are trying to link to the idea that this has all been instigated from abroad. So I think the Greek-British journalist, although apparently they have known him for a very long time. He knows Iran very well. He's traveled there a lot. For some reason, you know, he was targeted, and so was the Newsweek journalist. But I think this just points to this whole climate of intimidation that now exists in Tehran.
Will it chill what we hear out of Iran? Mazia Bahari had worked there for 15 years and served a number of Newsweek, certainly international clients. Will we be able to look inside in the same way? And what will happen to these people, do you think?
I think, obviously, it is becoming a lot more difficult to find out what's happening in Iran, because all journalists there, whether local or foreign, are under severe restrictions. I don't know how far they will go with their claims against journalists, whether their intention is to actually charge them with spying or simply to send a message to everybody else to be more careful. I think we need to wait a little bit to see whether any charges are issued against the ones who have been detained so far.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking with our weekly news roundtable, and you can join the conversation. What do you think about the latest events in Iran, about Michael Jackson's death, about the health care reform fight? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today by Rula Khalaf of the Financial Times, Froma Harrop of the Providence Journal, and Jack Beatty. And before we get to everybody, let's listen. At a White House news conference Tuesday, President Obama condemned the government crackdown in the aftermath of the Iranian election. One reporter asked Obama if he would ever accept President Ahmadinejad's, well, former president and president-to-be, Ahmadinejad's presidency. Here is his response.
What we know is that a sizable percentage of the Iranian people themselves, spanning Iranian society, consider this election illegitimate. It's not an isolated instance, little grumbling here or there. There is significant questions about the legitimacy of the election. And so ultimately, the most important thing for the Iranian government to consider is legitimacy in the eyes of its own people.
And here is Iran's ambassador to Mexico, Mohammad Hassan Gadiri, speaking on CNN yesterday. He said the opposition had used violence and deserved to be suppressed.
As long as opposition behaves peacefully, it will be treated peacefully. But once it enters violence and intends to impose its opinion on the majority, and especially when it is under the influence or intrigue or affiliation with countries that are enemies of Iran, it's natural that we will confront it.
Jack and Froma, I'd like to bring you in and ask you what you think of Rula's remarks, and maybe you have questions for her, and where do you think the U.S. is now with position to, with respect to what's going on in Iran?
As far as the U.S.'s position, before Tuesday, Obama had used tempered language in his World is Watching speech on June 15th. He said he was troubled by violence. He said we had no observers in Iran, so I can't state definitively one way or another what happened with respect to the election. But he also said that our national security interests require dealing with the likes of Ahmadinejad. You know, I imagine that he would have to say something stronger following the horrible footage of Nada dying. And so he did on Tuesday, but even then, he spoke of being appalled and outraged by the violence and crackdown, and he praised the peaceful protests and the timeless dignity of tens of thousands of Iranians marching in silence, and he made reference to Nada. But he didn't talk about the election itself. He took no sides as to who won. He didn't talk of a stolen election. And so clearly, you know, he's trying to not burn bridges. He's trying to prepare for the likelihood that he might have to deal with Ahmadinejad, and I think he'd like to talk to him later on.
Mm-hmm.
My question for Rula, though, the thing that intrigued and worried me when she mentioned that there was talk of applying the death penalty to some of the opposition. Does she think that would really happen, or or is that just a threat in her opinion?
Rula?
I've no idea if this will happen. I mean, it's possible that it would, but I see it, as I said, as part of this pattern of threat that have been issued over the past week or 10 days in order to essentially intimidate the opposition and force people to stay at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that happened, it would be very, very hard for Obama to negotiate with Ahmadinejad later on.
That's an interesting point. And actually, you know, in the clip we even just heard from, you hear President Obama questioning the legitimacy of the election. And yesterday, Ahmadinejad condemned even that as interference and basically hinted, if you want to talk later, you should stay out of this. It is a difficult position for the White House, is it not, Jack?
It is indeed. My question to Rula is, what do people in the opposition say about the United States and Obama? Do they want more overt denunciation? Do they want? Are they embarrassed by it, as some people here imply? What do people there say?
I think that's a very interesting question because, I mean, I've covered a lot of events in the Middle East, a lot of opposition rallies by various people. And I think what is really striking about Iran is people do not expect any help from abroad, not from the U.S., not from Europe, not from anyone. And I think what's very sad for the opposition today is that they've been linked by the regime, they've been linked so much with the outside when this was such a purely domestic movement. I think the big issue that people would have is that they want to deny the Ahmadinejad administration legitimacy. And if the U.S. were to negotiate with the Ahmadinejad administration and to lend them international diplomacy, I think people will feel as if this is a blow to them. So I think this is the dilemma that the U.S. now faces.
Yeah. Mm. Let's take a call here. Ron is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hello, Ron.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I want to just relay a comment that one of the commentators made, which is that one of the issues is because they were talking about 60% of the vote, and then there was also questions about the home area of the opposition. You realize that if the election was turned into a 52-48 type of end, there would be no discussion at all, and everybody would have been shut down. So that, you know, I mean, it's an observation, I guess.
Okay.
I want somebody to comment on that.
You're saying that if they hadn't been as manipulative and only a little manipulative, there would have been less protest? I don't know. Let's bounce that off of Rula. What do you think, Rula?
I think it depends on the percentages. I think if nobody had gotten 50%, then you would have had a second round, which is what most of us would have expected. I think if Ahmadinejad had been given 51% or 52%, which would have meant no second round, there would have been probably less anger. But I think that for the reformist opposition, it was, to them, such a blatant manipulation, such an insult, that enraged them even more.
Mm-hmm. Well, so perhaps when you talk about it as Kafkaesque, there are degrees that had they been a little more cautious, they might not have unleashed such fury. Let's take another call because it goes to this point about Western difficulties with Iran. Matthew is calling from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Matthew, thanks for your call.
Hi. I think that it's easy to paint Ahmadinejad and his regime as extremist when we so rarely bring in the historical context to the discussion. I think a little paranoia from the Iranian regime is justified given the numerous examples over the near history. Just 20 years ago, we sponsored a war with Iraq to go to war with Iran. And I think that we should bring those historical context into the discussion. I think it would be more helpful for both sides if there's a recognition, at least, more readily in the public debate of this influence by Western powers.
Thank you. Well, the irony of that, Rula, is that it is the very veterans of that war who seem to be in charge of the country today. Isn't that right?
Some of them, certainly, yes. I mean, there is a generation of Revolutionary Guard members who fought in the 1980-98 war with Iraq and who felt that it is their turn to be in power, and they are the backers of Ahmadinejad. But just to go back to the caller's remark, it's true that because of Iran's history and because of the history of Western meddling in Iran, the regime in Tehran does live in this very conspiratorial world. But we do have to separate that from what's happening today, because I think they know very well that the opposition is not influenced from abroad. But I think that has become such an easy way of discrediting anyone who stands against them.
If I may build on those remarks, I had lunch yesterday with an Iranian-born friend who supports the opposition, and she said that every Iranian she knows is very opposed to the United States becoming involved in any way, and it goes beyond giving Ahmadinejad ammunition to accuse them of being traitors, that the opposition themselves, they consider themselves patriots, and they hold some grievances against the United States. The overthrow of, the CIA-assisted overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953, the support of the Shah, the Iran-Iraq war, during which the United States sold Saddam Hussein ingredients for poison gas. And they also resent Bush's inclusion of Iran in the axis of evil.
That is very much resented, and I think a good point. But having personally made 5 trips to Iran between 1995 and 2000, I'd have to say that how Iranians view America is complex in a country that large, with an educational level that varies, and in different parts of the country. And there's often a lot of support for American ideas without perhaps supporting the American presidency. Can I just ask one quick question myself before we let you go, Rula? What about the idea that former president and revolutionary leader Rafsanjani might be able to outmaneuver the supreme leader Khamenei through this assembly of experts or these other Islamic bodies that he is in control of, or allying with clerics and Qom or anything like that? Joe Klein writes about that in this week's Time magazine, and I thought it was an interesting question.
It is indeed a very interesting question. Very frankly, I really don't think that anyone has the answer to it. This is not the institutions in the Islamic Republic are very opaque. They're very difficult to see. On the experts assembly, Rafsanjani is the head of the experts assembly. But all the clerics on the assembly are elected by the people, but they are vetted before they are elected. Their candidacy is vetted by the Guardian Council, mm-hmm. which answers to the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So one would assume that most of the people on that assembly, or at least many of the people, are supporters of the Ayatollah. So this isn't, although there is a mechanism that could put pressure or even depose the leader, I don't think that is easily achieved.
And Rula Khalaf, Jack, any last questions? I think we should let Rula go and turn to, we have a raft of domestic news this week. Rula, we really, really appreciate you being with us and your work in Iran for the Financial Times. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to one of the other stories certainly making the news this week. On Wednesday, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford admitted to having an affair with a woman in Argentina. He said his long-distance relationship with her allowed them to exchange inner feelings.
And so there was this zone of protectedness in that she lives thousands of miles away and I was up here and you could throw an idea out or vice versa. And we developed a remarkable friendship over those 8 years. And And then, as I said, about a year ago, it sparked into something more than that. I have seen her three times since then during that whole sparking thing.
I have to say, Jack and Fremmel, when I heard that, I just thought, TMI, too much information. I don't know. Your reactions, please.
You took the words right out of my mouth. He was telling us things we didn't have to know about, really. But, you know, in his case, and in his case, the adultery seems the least of it. It's the weirdness that really got to me. Disappearing a week without telling anyone, telling the nation that he just spent 5 days crying in Argentina. It's really...
And you forgot being lost on the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, that's that too. And oh, my goodness, I just... And just telling us all this.
Well, Jack, what do you make of it? I mean, we're getting used to public confessions in American politics, and at the moment... they seem to be coming from the Republican side. We had the John Edwards matter not so very long ago. Why the acceleration, if you will?
I don't know.
I ask you, Jack Beatty.
Yeah. No, I couldn't begin to say. But you know, to me, the significance of this and of the earlier John Ensign incident, both of them were putative candidates for president. I don't think they would have gone very far. But a more than putative candidate for president is affected by this, and that is Newt Gingrich. I think each of these scandals make it more and more unlikely that Gingrich, who really was a serial adulterer, will run for president. I think that he's the real loser in this, and he was, or at least was thought to be, a very strong contender. He certainly was, he was ubiquitous on the television. He was talking about everything, taking on Obama. And, of course, he slipped grievously when he referred to Judge Sotomayor as a Latina racist. That wasn't going to help him with Hispanic voters. But nevertheless, within the Republican tribe, he was looking better and better. I think with each of these scandals, he looks worse and worse.
Let's see if we can very, very quickly take a caller. Hope is calling from Camden, South Carolina. Hope?
Hi, Jackie.
Your point?
We are outraged in South Carolina. I have a couple of comments about Governor Sanford. First of all, he declined our stimulus money. All the while, he had paid for his trip to Argentina, $8,000 worth with our tax dollars. Now he says he's going to pay it back. Secondly, he said that marriage should be between a man and a woman, and that is, you know, the way that God meant it. I guess he means it should be between a man and a woman and a mistress. And, you know, it is his business and all that, but as somebody mentioned before about him taking leave of our state without letting anyone know, not putting anyone in charge, could our commentators speak on this?
Well, they can, but we're going to have to wait till after the break for them to do so. And so I will ask Jack and Fromma to stand by and everyone to just hold their thoughts for a moment. I'm Jackie Lytton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. This week, lots of news on the entertainment front. The new Transformers sequel broke a box office record on its opening night this week.
Megatron wants what's in my mind.
I'm not going to go without you.
Actress Farrah Fawcett of Charlie's Angels fame and more passed away. At the 2006 Emmys, she reunited with the other Angels.
The three of us didn't experience the Charlie's Angels phenomenon like the rest of the world did. We experienced it from the inside. The eye of that televised storm together.
And Ed McMahon, Johnny Carson's famous sidekick, is dead. He's got a place in TV history, of course, with this one.
Here's Johnny.
You You can join the conversation. What's your view on health care reform? Is the U.S. moving fast enough on climate change? And where does the GOP stand in the wake of the Mark Sanford confession? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're joined today by Froma Harrop of the Providence Journal and Jack Beattie. And Froma and Jack, I got to tell you, the screen is lighting up with comments about Mark Sanford, and I feel we should let the people have their say. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
All right, so here we go. Diane is calling from Diane is calling from Washington, D.C. Hello, Diane.
Hello, Jackie. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Quick comment. I took a different perspective from Governor Sanford's admission. I thought it was humanistic. I didn't think it was too much information at all. I think it was a departure from what we're used to, a prepared statement, and it showed compassion rather than a lack of sincerity. And so I think the gas and the TMI were was genuine rather than what we're usually used to. So rather than it being too much information, let me just go on record as well as saying I'm an independent, formerly Democrat. He didn't sway me in any way other than to show a human being that is obviously conflicted. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you,
Diane. Since that was a comment, I'd like to get another South Carolina caller into the show. Hannah is calling from Sumter, South Carolina.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
I was just calling in regards to the Mark Sanford discussion. I'm a University of South Carolina college student. And recently, after the confession, I've been reading a lot of, I think that the paper has divulged too much information, and I think people have started to focus more on aspects of Mark Sanford that I don't think are as important. As a South Carolina citizen, I've been outraged with him recently over the stimulus package and whatnot because I feel he's toyed with a lot of people's futures. If the stimulus money hadn't been taken by South Carolina, then my college tuition, as well as many other students, would have risen 16%, which is ridiculous. And I think issues like that are now going to be overshadowed by his personal life, which, of course, is important. But I think coming from a South Carolina perspective and seeing just how much people are interested in knowing every little detail here, it's far too much. And I understand the importance of holding our representatives of our state to certain standards, but I think that as far as the too much information aspect of it, I completely agree with you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Hannah. Jack?
Yeah, well, I was struck with the same thing that, it looked to me as if he was sacrificing the interests of the citizens of South Carolina in that whole deal, turning down nearly $1 billion, meaning teachers would have to be fired, taxes would have to go up, university students like Hannah would have to pay higher tuition. He was sacrificing those people for his larger political ambitions, which he wanted to oppose before the Republican primary electorate nationally as a principled defender of prudent spending. And he wasn't going to take any tainted federal money, and he wasn't going to be undone by that. And that just seemed clearly that he was putting his own presidential prospects ahead of the people he was elected to serve.
Right. One more call from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Peggy. Hello, Peggy.
Hi, Jackie. My husband and I have talked about this at length over the last few days. What goes on in Governor Sanford's private life is that's his private life. I don't agree with it. It was morally wrong. That's something that he and his family have to deal with. Our biggest issue is that he left all of us as South Carolinians with no one to go to in case of an emergency, that we're in hurricane season, and he wasn't even available. And that's wrong, and we both think that, frankly, he ought to resign.
From Harrop, there's been a lot said. Thank you very much for that comment, Peggy. There's been a lot said, from about where this leaves the GOP leadership. But, I'm also intrigued with this question of where it left the people of South Carolina and this nexus between someone who is charged with governing, has accepted the vote of the people, and that is a different kind of betrayal than what he does in his family, and that's what these callers seem to be saying.
Yes, and I happen to agree entirely with Peggy that that you know his biggest failure here, as far as I was concerned, was leaving the state for a week without telling anyone where he was, and you know, hurricane season or any number of other disasters could have befallen South Carolina, and he wouldn't have been there, and he wouldn't have been reachable. That would be a very bad thing, and I think that's the most serious charge against him right now.
Well, the one thing that's removing that story, at least from the top headline right now, is all the other things that are following on behind it. So we're going to turn the page as well and thank everybody for commenting on that. And let's go to health care. Republican opposition to the health care reform draft bill has been strong, as we all know. Here is Ohio Republican and House Minority Leader John Boehner yesterday criticizing the Democrats' proposal.
I don't think Americans want a big government-run program. They don't want their care rationed, and they clearly don't think they should be paying more. And all the proposals we've seen on health care are going to cost somewhere between $1 trillion and $2 trillion of new taxes on the American people to spend more on health care. Most Americans think they're already spending too much on health care. Even the president said, you know, the problem with health care is we're spending too much.
And here is U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius testifying before the House Wednesday on health care reform. And she said reform will be fully funded without further big spending.
Our challenge is how to take the best practices and spread them across the entire country. I have every confidence we can meet this challenge and achieve our goals of reducing costs for families, businesses, and government, protecting people's choices of doctors, hospitals, and health plans, and at long last, assuring affordable, quality health care for all Americans. And we can do it without adding to the deficit. Now, the president is open to good ideas about how we finance health reform, but we're not open to deficit spending. Health reform will be paid for, and it will be deficit neutral over 10 years.
Deficit neutral. Well, of course, this is an enormous story and an enormous impact on American life. Where do you think we are now? It's almost incredible that after all this time, Jack and Froma, we're talking about July 6th getting something on the table.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that $1 trillion figure that everyone is getting very excited about. I think David Brooks this week called it devastating, and it wasn't devastating to me. It wasn't even surprising. As a point of comparison, in 2006, the Medicare drug benefit was projected to cost more than $1 trillion over 10 years. This was one benefit serving one slice of the population. A year later, that projection was reduced to just under $1 trillion, and the Bush administration congratulated itself for saving the taxpayers' money. The HHS Secretary, Michael Levitt, said that the decline showed, quote, that competition among private plans had effectively held down costs. Now, let us add here that the Medicare drug benefit was passed with absolutely no thought of paying for it. There wasn't even an attempt to pay for it. And so this $1 trillion figure should be looked in perspective. Also, you know, Americans do spend $2.2 trillion a year on health care. So $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion over 10 years is not an outrageous number.
Yeah, you had that in one of your columns, Froma, I believe. And I thought it was interesting that that seemed like a very pragmatic response from you, identifying with a lot of conservative issues. I thought that it sounded like you were sort of just trying to look reality in the eye.
Yes, well, I believe that health care reform must be paid for. So I guess that may make me a fiscal conservative. Well, I am a fiscal conservative. And so but I don't think that $1 trillion in health, $1 trillion spent on health care reform, is an impossible number to finance.
Jack, you've done some reporting of your own recently on these numbers, haven't you?
Well, on a little micro part of it, I've been watching the markup in the Health Committee, Senator Dodd's committee, really Senator Kennedy's committee, as they've debated various amendments to the bill they're putting together. And yesterday there was a very telling exchange. Senator McCain introduced an amendment that would have allowed for the importation of drugs from abroad. He was seconded by that by Senator Brown from Ohio, and Senator Brown intimated that to be against this, you had to be in the pocket of the drug lobby. And he didn't gesture to the audience, but we know from reporting on NPR that the audience is full of lobbyists. And you can be sure in the front row, the drug lobbyists are there. Well, Senator Mikulski of Maryland, a Democrat, took strong exception to this. She says, I'm not doubtful on this because of money from the drug companies. It's a safety issue with me. Anyway, they had their vote. And the amendment was turned down. And so I wondered, well, who was paying, you know, if you looked at the records, you know, I expected to find that Mikulski was getting more money from the drug companies than Brown, who voted with McCain. In fact, Mikulski and Brown got just about the same amount over the last 20 years, about $250,000 over 20 years. McCain, who introduced the amendment, has gotten $800,000 over 20 years, yet he was for the importation of foreign drugs. The only person there I could really clearly see as someone who was unbought in any way was, of course, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who over 20 years has received $1,300 from the drug companies. So it isn't so easy to see a one-to-one relation between campaign spending and their votes on particular things. But what is clear is just how much money is pumped in by these private interests into the system. $800,000 for John McCain over 20 years, yeah. On and on and on. Well, but at least in that one amendment, you could say that it's hard to do a one-to-one, Mikulski was bribed, so she voted. It didn't look that way at all.
Well, when they call it reform, we're not only talking, I think, about the care in medical areas itself, reform in lots of ways that all of this has been funded. Let's get our callers in on this. Naomi is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi there, Naomi.
Hi. Yes, I've had the opportunity to live in different countries around the world, and I'm amazed to hear people having this huge, passionate discussion about socialized medicine and how healthcare in this country will be rationed. Healthcare in this country is more rationed than almost anywhere else I have ever lived. I lived in France, I lived in England with public health, and was never afraid of getting sick or having somebody in my family get sick, even though I have health insurance. Knowing that, you know, the health insurance can turn this down or can turn that down. And I think that American people have been frightened by this idea of socialized medicine with no real discussion about what that looks like.
Okay. Thank you for that comment, Naomi. Let's take another call. Philip is calling from Boston.
Yes. I just want to ask a question. Actually a comment. My question is, we have a public funding services for healthcare like Medicare and Medicaid, and we know that these services are not well funded, and the quality of the services is very poor. And so, if we have those just a small percentage of coverage for public funding and it's not even fulfilled promise, how comes we want to cover everybody in America?
Okay, no, thank you, Philip. Actually, there have been some interesting ideas booted about in terms of how the administration is saying it's going to pay for this without adding to the deficit. From it, maybe you can just quickly elucidate a couple of those and say whether or not you think that's possible.
That's possible to pay for it without adding to the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think Jack mentioned this a week ago or 2 weeks ago. You know, the proposal of a VAT tax, a value-added tax, this would be a broad national sales tax.
Sometimes called the hidden tax.
Huh?
Sometimes called the hidden tax.
Yes, and Europeans use it to raise enormous amounts of money to pay for their social programs. And, in fact, this week, the three House committees involved in formulating health reform mentioned the VAT as one option.
Yes.
I like that a lot better than a tax on soda pop, mm-hmm. which is another I think, crazy proposal.
Well, and of course, the appeal of a VAT tax or value-added tax is that everyone pays it at point of purchase. Anybody who's ever gone on a trip to Europe has paid this. And it's non-discriminatory in that way, so it doesn't excite quite the same lobbying issues as soda pop tax, sugar beet producers. You know, it's not political in quite the same ways.
Yeah.
Do you think so, Jack?
Yeah, it's a slyer tax, to put it that way. But I mean, you know, we have to pay for these things somehow. And I think that Obama, I'm repeating something I've said before, but I regret most in his campaign his insistence that people with incomes below $250,000 aren't going to have to pay any more taxes for anything. That's not a credible, that wasn't when he made it, and it's less and less now a responsible position to take. We have collective responsibilities, and we have to meet them collectively through the tax code if we want government to do all the things that Obama wants it to do.
Well, government did a lot this week in more ways than one and more than we can get to in even 1 hour. But I want to thank all of you. Thank both of you for being with us. Roma Harrop, syndicated columnist and editorial board member with the Providence Journal. Jack Beatty, both of you have a great weekend. And we're going to be talking about the late Michael Jackson in the next hour. Who thought we'd be saying that at this time in a life only 50 years old and his tremendous impact on our culture? And you can join the On Point conversation on our podcast, on our website, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Jackie Leiden, and I'm in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.